The magic, after all, and years upon years of teaching and sharing magic and worse. Writing it down in fancy books that get all dusty with age has lessened it, removed its power bit by bit. It was inevitable, perhaps, but not unavoidable. Everyone makes mistakes. The greatest wizard in history made the mistake of sharing his secrets, and his secrets were both magic and important, so it was a rather serious mistake. He told them to a girl. She was young and clever and beautiful. Poppet snorts into her cup. Widget stops. "I'm sorry," she says. "Go on, please, Widge." "She was young and clever and beautiful," Widget continues, "because if the girl had not been beautiful and clever, she would have been easier to resist, and then there would be no story at all." The wizard was old and quite clever himself, of course, and he had gone a very, very long time without telling his secrets to anyone at all. Maybe over the years he had forgotten about the importance of keeping them, or maybe he was distracted by her youth or beauty or cleverness. Maybe he was just tired, or maybe he had too much wine and didn't realize what he was doing. Whatever the circumstances, he told his deepest secrets to the girl, the hidden keys to all his magic. And when the secrets had passed from wizard to girl, they lost bits of their power, the way cats lose bits of fur when you pet them thoroughly. But they were still potent and effective and magical, and the girl used them against the wizard. She tricked him so that she could take his secrets and make them her own. She did not particularly care about keeping them. She probably wrote them down somewhere as well. The wizard himself she trapped in a huge old oak tree, a tree like this one, and the magic she used to do so was strong, since it was the wizard's own magic, ancient and powerful, and he could not undo it. She left him there, and he could not be rescued, since no one else knew he was inside the tree. He was not dead, though. The girl might have killed him if she could, after she had coerced his secrets out of him. But she could not kill him with his own magic, though maybe she didn't want to at all. She was more concerned with power than with him, but she might have cared about him a little, enough to want to leave him with his life, in a way. She settled for trapping him, and to her mind, it served the same purpose. Though really she did not succeed quite as well as she liked to think. She was careless in keeping her new magic secret. She flaunted it, and generally did not take very good care of it. Its power faded eventually, and so did she. The wizard, on the other hand, became part of the tree, and the tree thrived and grew, its branches spreading up to the sky, and its roots reaching farther into the earth. He was part of the leaves and the bark and the sap, and part of the acorns that were carried away by squirrels to become new oak trees in other places. And when those trees grew, he was in those branches and leaves and roots as well. So, by losing his secrets, the wizard gained immortality. His tree stood long after the clever young girl was old and no longer beautiful, and in a way, he became greater and stronger than he had ever been before. Though, if he were given the chance to do it all over again, he likely would have been more careful with his secrets.
As Widget finishes, the tent settles into silence again, but the tree feels more alive than it had before he started.
"Thank you," Poppet says. "That was a good one. Kind of sad, though, but kind of not at the same time." "You're welcome,"
Widget says. He takes a sip of his cider, now more warm than hot. He holds his cup in his hands and brings it to eye level, staring at it until a soft curl of steam rises from the surface.
"Do mine too, please," Poppet says, holding out her cup. "I can never do it right." "Well, I can never levitate anything right, so we're even,"
Widget says, but he takes her cup without complaint and concentrates until it too is steaming and hot again. He moves to hand it back to her as it floats from his hand to hers, the surface of the cider wavering with the motion, but otherwise moving as smoothly as if it were sliding across a table.
"Show off," Widget says.
They sit sipping their newly warm cider, looking up at the twisting black branches reaching toward the top of the tent.
"Widge?"
Poppet asks after a long silence.
"Yes? Is it not that bad to be trapped somewhere, then? Depending on where you're trapped. I suppose it depends on how much you like the place you're trapped in," Widget says. "And how much you like whoever you're stuck there with,"
Poppet adds, kicking his black boot with her white one. Her brother laughs, and the sound echoes through the tent, carried over the branches that are covered in candles, each flame flickering and white. Temporary Places. London, April 1895. Tara Burgess does not realize until after she has returned to London that the address on the card given to her by Mr. Barris is not a private residence at all, but the Midland Grand Hotel. She leaves the card sitting out on a table in her parlor for some time, glancing at it whenever she happens to be in the room, forgetting about it for stretches of time until she remembers it again. Lainey attempts to persuade Tara to join her for an extended holiday in Italy, but she refuses. Tara tells her sister little about her visit to Vienna, saying only that Ethan asked after her. Lainey suggests that they might consider moving, and perhaps they should discuss it further when she returns. Tara only nods, giving her sister a warm embrace before Lainey departs. Alone in their townhouse, Tara wanders absently. She abandons half-read novels on chairs and tables. The invitations from Madame Padva to join her for tea or accompany her to the ballet are politely declined. She turns all of the mirrors in the house to face the walls. Those she cannot manage to turn, she covers with sheets, so they sit like ghosts in empty rooms. She has trouble sleeping. One afternoon, after the card has sat patiently gathering dust for months, she picks it up and places it in her pocket, and she is out of the door and on her way to the train before she can decide whether or not the idea is a good one. Tara has never visited the clock-topped hotel attached to St. Pancras Station, but it strikes her immediately as a temporary place. Despite the size and solidity of the building, it feels impermanent, populated by a constant stream of guests and travelers on their way to and from other locations, stopping only briefly before continuing to other destinations. She inquires at the desk, but they claim they have no such person listed as a guest. She repeats the name several times after the desk clerk keeps mishearing her. She tries more than one variation, as the words on the card from Mr. Barris have been smudged, and she cannot recall the proper pronunciation. The longer she stands there, the more unsure she becomes that she has ever even heard the smudged name on the card pronounced. The clerk politely asks if she would like to leave a note, if perhaps the gentleman in question were to be arriving later in the day. But Tara declines, thanking the clerk for his time and replacing the card in her pocket. She wanders the lobby, wondering if the address is incorrect, though it is not like Mr. Barris to provide anything less than exact information.
"Good afternoon, Miss Burgess,"
a voice next to her says. She has not noticed him approach, but the man whose name she still cannot recall the proper pronunciation of is standing by her shoulder in his distinctive grey suit.
"Good afternoon," she echoes. "Were you looking for me?"
he asks.
"I was, in fact,"
Tara says. She starts to explain that Mr. Barris sent her. She reaches into her pocket, but there is no card within it, and she stops, confused.
"Is something wrong?"
the man in the grey suit asks.
"No,"
Tara says, now unsure if she remembered to bring the card, or if it is still sitting on a table in her parlor.
"I wanted to speak with you about the circus."
"Very well," he says. He waits for her to begin, his expression bearing something that could be construed as very mild interest. She does her best to explain her concern, that there is more going on with the circus than most people are privy to, that there are elements she can find no reasonable explanations for. She repeats some of the things she mentioned to Mr. Barris, the concern of not being able to be certain if anything is real, how disconcerting it is to look in a mirror and see the same face, unchanged, for years. She falters frequently, finding it difficult to articulate precisely what she means. The expression of very mild interest does not change.
"What is it you would like from me, Miss Burgess?" he asks when she has finished. "I would like an explanation," she says.
He regards her with the same unchanged expression for some time.
"The circus is simply a circus," he says. "An impressive exhibition, but no more than that. Don't you agree?"
Tara nods before she can properly process the response.
"Do you have a train to catch, Miss Burgess?" he asks.
"Yes," Tara says. She had forgotten about her train. She wonders what time it is, but she cannot find a clock to check.
"I am headed toward the station myself, if you do not mind an escort."
They walk the short distance from the hotel to the train platforms together. He holds doors open for her. He makes empty remarks about the weather.
"I think it may be in your best interest to find something else to occupy your time," he says when they reach the trains. "Something to take your mind off the circus. Don't you agree?"
Tara nods again.
"Good day, Miss Burgess," he says with a tip of his hat.
"Good day," she echoes.
He leaves her on the platform, and when she turns after him to see which way he went, the grey suit is nowhere to be found amongst the crowd. Tara stands near the edge of the platform waiting for her train. She cannot recall telling Mr. A.H. which train it was she would be taking, but he has deposited her on the proper platform nonetheless. She feels as though there was something else she meant to ask, but now she cannot recall what it was. She cannot recall much of anything about the conversation, save for the impression that there is something else she should be spending her time on, somewhere else to be, some other matter that is more deserving of her attention. She is wondering what that might be when a flash of grey on the opposite platform catches her eye. Mr. A.H. stands in a shadowy corner, and even with the distance and the shadows, Tara can tell that he is arguing with someone she cannot see. Other people pass by without even glancing in their direction. When the light from the arching overhead windows shifts, Tara can see who Mr. A.H. is arguing with. The man is not quite as tall. The top of his hat sits leveled, like a step down from the grey one, so much so that at first Tara thinks the man is only a reflection, and finds it odd that Mr. A.H. would be arguing with his own reflection in the middle of a train station. But the other suit is distinctly darker. The reflection's hair is longer, though it is a similar shade of grey. Through the steam and the crowd, Tara can make out the bright spots of lace at the cuffs of the shirt, the dark eyes that catch the light more than the rest of the man's face. Aspects settle temporarily, and then vanish into distorted shadows once more, never remaining steady for more than a moment. The light filtering in from above shifts again, and the figure quavers, as though she were watching through a heat haze, though Mr. A.H. remains comparatively crisp and clear. Tara takes a step forward, her gaze fixated on the apparition on the opposite platform. She does not see the train. Movement. Munich, April 1895. Herr Thiessen is always pleased when the circus arrives in his native Germany, but this time he is particularly delighted that it has arrived quite near Munich. So there is no need for him to secure rooms in another city. Also, he has been promised a visit from Miss Celia Bowen. He has never met her, though they have been exchanging letters for years, and she expressed an interest in seeing his workshop, if he would not mind.
Friedrich replied that of course he did not mind in the least, and she would be welcome at any time. Despite so many letters, each carefully filed in his office, he is uncertain what to expect when she arrives. He is astonished to find the woman he knows as the illusionist standing in his doorway. She is unmistakable, though she wears a gown of dusty rose rather than the black and white creations he is accustomed to seeing her in. Her skin appears warmer, her hair softly curled, and her hat bears no resemblance to the distinctive silk-top hat, but he would know her face anywhere. "This is an honor," he says by way of greeting. "Most people don't recognize me outside of the circus," Celia says as he takes her hand. "Then most people are fools," he says, lifting her hand to his lips and lightly kissing the back of her glove. "Though I feel a fool myself for not knowing who you were all this time." "I should have told you," Celia says. "I do apologize. No apology is necessary. I should have guessed you were not merely a rêveur from the way you wrote about the circus. You know every corner better than most." "I am familiar with a great deal of the corners, not all of them." "There remains mysteries in the circus even for its own illusionist? That is impressive." Celia laughs, and Friedrich takes her on a tour of his workshop. The workshop is organized so that the front is occupied mostly by blueprints and sketches, moving on to long tables covered in various parts, and a great deal of sawdust, drawers full of gears and tools. Celia listens with rapt attention as he describes the entire process, asking questions about the technical aspects as well as the creative ones. He is surprised to learn that she speaks fluent German, though they have only written each other in English. "I speak languages with more ease than I read or write them," she explains. "It is something in the feel of the sounds. I could attempt to put them on paper, but I am sure the result would be appalling." Despite his graying hair, Friedrich looks younger when he smiles. Celia cannot keep her eyes from his hands as he shows her the delicate clockwork mechanisms. She pictures the same fingers inscribing each letter she has received and read so many times that she has committed them to memory, finding it strange that she feels shy with someone she knows so well. He watches her with equal attentiveness as they traverse the shelves of timepieces in various stages of construction. "May I ask you something?" he says, as she looks at a collection of detailed figurines waiting patiently amongst curls of wood to be housed in their proper clocks. "Of course," Celia says, though she fears he will ask her how she does her magic, and she dreads having to lie to him. "You have been in the same city as I on so many occasions, and yet this is the first time you have asked to meet. Why is that?" Celia looks back at the figurines on the table before she responds. Friedrich reaches out and rights a tiny ballerina that has fallen sideways, returning her to balance on her ribboned slippers. "Before, I did not want you to know who I was," Celia says. "I thought you might think of me differently if you did, but after so long I felt I was being dishonest. I had wanted to tell you the truth for some time, and I could not resist the chance to see your workshop. I hope you can forgive me."
"You have nothing to be forgiven for," Friedrich says. "A woman I should like to think I know rather well, and a woman I had always considered a mystery, are, in fact, the same person. It is surprising, but I do not mind a good surprise, though I am curious as to why you wrote me that first letter."
"I enjoyed your writings about the circus," Celia says. "It is a perspective that I am not able to view it from properly because I understand it in a different way. I like being able to see it through your eyes." When she looks up at him, his soft blue eyes are bright in the afternoon sunlight that shines through the windows, illuminating the speckles of sawdust in the air.
"Thank you, Miss Bowen," Friedrich says.
"Celia," she corrects. He gives her a thoughtful nod before continuing the tour. The back walls are covered with finished or nearly finished timepieces,
clocks waiting only for final coats of varnish or other minor details. The clocks closest to the windows are already in motion, each moving in its unique way, but keeping the same harmonious rhythm, a symphony of carefully ordered ticking. The one that attracts Celia's attention rests on a table rather than hanging on the wall or sitting on a shelf. It is a beautiful piece, more sculpture than clock. While many of the clocks are wood, this one is predominantly dark, oxidized metal. A large round cage set on a wooden base that has been carved into swirling white flames. Within, there are overlapping metal hoops marked with numbers and symbols suspended from the top, hanging amongst the visible gears, and a series of stars falling from the filigree cap at the top. But the clock sits quiet, unmoving. "This one reminds me of the bonfire," Celia says. "Is it not finished?"
"No, it is complete, but broken," Friedrich replies. "It was an experiment, and the components are difficult to balance properly."
He turns it so she can see the way the workings extend through the entirety of the cage, stretching in all directions.
"The mechanics are complex, as it tracks astronomical movement as well. I shall have to remove the base and dismantle it entirely to get it running again. I have not yet had the time it will require."
"May I?" Celia asks, reaching out to touch it. When he nods, she removes one of her gloves and rests her hand on the metal bars of the cage. She only watches it thoughtfully. She makes no attempt to move it. To Friedrich, it appears she is gazing through the clock rather than simply looking at it. Inside, the mechanism begins to turn, the cogs and gears waltzing together as the number-marked hoops spin into place. The hands glide to indicate the proper time. The planetary alignments set themselves in order. Everything within the cage rotates slowly, the silver stars sparkling as they catch the light. Once the slow, steady tick begins, Celia removes her hand. Friedrich does not inquire as to how she managed it. Instead, he takes her to dinner. They do speak of the circus, but spend most of the meal discussing books and art, wine and favorite cities. The pauses in the conversation are not awkward, though they struggle to find the same rhythm in speaking that was already present in their written exchanges, often switching from one language to another. "Why haven't you asked me how I do my tricks?" Celia asks, once they have reached the point where she is certain he is not simply being polite about the matter. Friedrich considers the question thoroughly before he responds.
"Because I do not wish to know," he says. "I prefer to remain unenlightened, to better appreciate the dark."
The sentiment delights Celia, so that she cannot properly respond in any of their common languages, and only smiles at him over her wine.
"Besides," Friedrich continues, "you must be asked such things constantly. I find I am more interested in learning about the woman than the magician. I hope that is acceptable."
"It's perfect," Celia says. They walk together to the circus afterward, past red-roofed buildings glowing in the dying light, going their separate ways only once they reach the courtyard. Friedrich remains mystified as to why no one seems to recognize her as she walks anonymously amongst the crowd. When he watches her performance, she only catches his eye once with a subtle smile, giving no other hints of recognition. Later, long after midnight, she appears by his side as he walks, wearing a cream-colored coat and a deep green scarf.
"Your scarf should be red," Friedrich remarks. "I am not a proper reverer," Celia says. "It would not feel right."
But as she speaks, her scarf shifts in hue to a rich wine-like burgundy.
"Is that better?" "It is perfect," Friedrich says, though his gaze remains fixed on her eyes.
She takes his offered arm, and they walk together along the twisting pathways through the dwindling crowd of patrons. They repeat this routine in the following evenings, though the circus does not remain in Munich long.
once the news arrives from London. In loving memory of Tara Burgess. Glasgow, April 1895. The funeral is a quiet one, despite the number of mourners present. There are no sobs or flailing handkerchiefs. There is a smattering of colour amongst the sea of traditional black. Even the light rain cannot push it down into the realms of despair. It rests instead in a space of thoughtful melancholy. Perhaps it is because it does not feel as though Tara Burgess is entirely gone when her sister sits alive and well, one half of the pair still breathing and vibrant. And at the same time, something looks strikingly wrong to everyone who lays eyes on the surviving sister. Something they can't quite put their finger on. Something out of balance. An occasional tear rolls down Lainey Burgess's cheek, but she greets each mourner with a smile and thanks them for attending. She makes jokes that Tara might have quipped were she not inside the polished wood coffin. There are no other family members present, though some less familiar acquaintances assume that the white-haired woman and bespectacled man who seldom leave Lainey's side are her mother and husband, respectively. While they are incorrect, neither Madame Padva nor Mr. Barris mind the mistake. There are countless roses. Red roses, white roses, pink roses. There is even a single black rose amongst the blossoms, though no one knows its origin. Chandrish takes credit only for the white blooms, keeping one pinned to his lapel that he toys with distractedly throughout the service. When Lainey speaks about her sister, her words are met with sighs and laughter and sad smiles. "I do not mourn the loss of my sister, because she will always be with me in my heart," she says. "I am, however, rather annoyed that my Tara has left me to suffer you lot alone. I do not see as well without her. I do not hear as well without her. I do not feel as well without her. I would be better off without a hand or a leg than without my sister. Then, at least, she would be here to mock my appearance and claim to be the pretty one for a change. We have all lost our Tara, but I have lost a part of myself as well." In the cemetery there is a single performer that even some of the mourners who are not part of Le Cirque des Rêves recognize, though the woman, bedecked from head to toe in snowiest white, has added a pair of feathered wings to her costume. They cascade down her back and flutter gently in the breeze while she remains still as stone. Many of the attendants seem surprised by her presence, but they take their cues from Lainey, who is delighted at the sight of the living angel standing over her sister's grave. It was the Burgess sisters, after all, who originated the tradition of such statues within the circus. Performers standing stock still with elaborate costumes and painted skin on platforms set up in precarious spaces between tents. If watched for hours, they sometimes change position entirely, but the motion will be agonizingly slow, to the point that many observers insist that they are cleverly crafted automatons and not proper people. The circus contains several of these performers: the star-speckled Empress of the Night, the cold, dark Black Pirate. The one that now watches over Tara Burgess is most often referred to as the Snow Queen. There is the softest of sobbing as the coffin is lowered into the ground, but it is difficult to pinpoint who it is coming from, or if it is instead a collective sound of mingled sighs and wind and shifting feet. The rain increases, and umbrellas sprout like mushrooms amongst the graves. The damp dirt turns quickly to mud, and the remainder of the burial is hastened to accommodate the weather. The ceremony fades out rather than ending properly, the mourners shifting from neat rows to mingling crowd without a distinct moment to mark the change. Many linger to pass additional condolences on to Lainey, though some move off to seek shelter from the rain before the last of the dirt has settled.
Isabel and Tsukiko stand side by side some distance from Tara's grave, sharing a large black umbrella that Isabel holds over their heads in one black-gloved hand. Tsukiko insists she does not mind the rain, but Isabel shelters her anyway, grateful for the company.
"How did she die?"
Tsukiko asks. It is a question that others have asked in hushed whispers throughout the afternoon, and has been met with various answers, few of them satisfying. Those who know the details are not forthcoming.
"I was told it was an accident," Isabel says quietly. "She was hit by a train."
Tsukiko nods thoughtfully, pulling a silver cigarette holder and matching lighter from the pocket of her coat.
"How did she really die?" she asks.
"What do you mean?" Isabel says, looking around to see if anyone is close enough to overhear their conversation. But most of the mourners have dissipated into the rain. Only a handful remain, including Celia Bowen with Poppet Murray clinging to her gown, the girl wearing a frown that seems more angry than sad. Lainey and Mr. Barris stand next to Tara's grave, the angel hovering over them close enough to lay its hands upon their heads.
"You have seen things that defy belief, have you not?" Tsukiko asks.
Isabel nods.
"Do you think perhaps those things would be more difficult to reconcile if you were not part of them yourself? Perhaps to the point of driving one mad? The mind is a sensitive thing."
"I don't think she stepped in front of the train on purpose," Isabel says, trying to keep her voice as low as possible.
"Perhaps not," Tsukiko says. "I contend it is a possibility, at the very least."
She lights her cigarette, the flame catching easily despite the dampness of the air.
"It could have been an accident," Isabel says. "Have you had any accidents recently? Any broken bones, burns, any injury at all?" Tsukiko asks.
"No," Isabel says.
"Have you taken ill, even the slightest of sniffles?"
"No." Isabel racks her brain for the last time she felt under the weather, and she can only come up with a head cold she had a decade ago, the winter before she met Marco.
"I do not believe any of us have since the circus started," Tsukiko says, "and no one has died until now. No one has been born either, not since the Murray twins, though it is not for lack of trying, given the way some of the acrobats carry on."
Isabel starts, but cannot finish. It is too much for her to wrap her mind around, and she is not sure she wants to be able to understand it.
"We are fish in a bowl, dear," Tsukiko tells her, cigarette holder dangling precariously from her lips. "Very carefully monitored fish, watched from all angles. If one of us floats to the top, it was not accidental. And if it was an accident, I worry that the watchers are not as careful as they should be."
Isabel stays silent. She wishes Marco had accompanied Chandresh, though she doubts he would answer any of her questions, if he consented to speaking to her at all. Every reading she has done privately on the matter has been complicated, but there is always the presence of strong emotion on his part. She knows he cares about the circus. She has never had any reason to doubt that.
"Have you ever read your cards for someone who could not understand what they were dealing with, even though to you it was clear from only a short conversation and pictures on paper?" Tsukiko asks.
"Yes," Isabel says. She has seen them hundreds of times, the querents who could not see things for what they were, blind to betrayals and heartbreak, and always stubborn, no matter how gently she tried to explain.
"It is difficult to see a situation for what it is when you are in the midst of it," Tsukiko says. "It is too familiar, too comfortable."
Tsukiko pauses. The curls of smoke from her cigarette slide between the raindrops as they wind around her head and up into the damp air.
"Perhaps the late Miss Burgess was close enough to the edge that she could see it differently," she says.
Isabel frowns, looking back toward Tara's grave. Laney and Mr. Barris have turned and are walking away slowly, his arm around her shoulders.
"Have you ever been in love, Kiko?" Isabel asks.
Tsukiko's shoulders stiffen as she exhales slowly. For a moment, Isabel thinks her question will go unanswered. But then she replies,
"I have had affairs that lasted decades and others that lasted hours. I have loved princesses and peasants, and I suppose they loved me, each in their way."
This is a typical Tsukiko response, one that does not truly answer the question. Isabel does not pry.
"It will come apart," Tsukiko says after a long while.
Isabel does not need to ask what she means.
"The cracks are beginning to show. Sooner or later it is bound to break."
She pauses to take a final drag off her cigarette.
"Are you still tempering?"
"Yes," Isabel says, "but I don't think it's helping.
It is difficult to discern the effect of such things, you know. Your perspective is from the inside, after all. The smallest charms can be the most effective."
"It doesn't seem to be very effective."
"Perhaps it is controlling the chaos within more than the chaos without."
Isabel does not reply. Tsukiko shrugs and says no more. After a moment, they turn to leave together without discussion. The snow-white angel alone remains, hovering over Tara Burgess's fresh grave, holding a single black rose in one hand. She does not move, does not even bat an eyelash. Her powdered face stays frozen in sorrow. The increasing rain pulls stray feathers from her wings and pins them to the mud below. Labyrinth. You walk down a hallway papered in playing cards, row upon row of clubs and spades. Lanterns fashioned from additional cards hang above, swinging gently as you pass by. A door at the end of the hall leads to a spiraling iron staircase. The stairs go both up and down. You go up, finding a trapdoor in the ceiling. The room it opens into is full of feathers that flutter downward. When you walk through them, they fall like snow over the door in the floor, obscuring it from sight. There are six identical doors. You choose one at random, trailing a few feathers with you. The scent of pine is overwhelming as you enter the next room, to find yourself in a forest full of evergreen trees. Only these trees are not green, but bright and white, luminous in the darkness surrounding them. They are difficult to navigate. As soon as you begin walking, the walls are lost in shadows and branches. There is a sound like a woman laughing nearby, or perhaps it is only the rustling of the trees as you push your way forward, searching for the next door, the next room. You feel the warmth of breath on your neck, but when you turn, there is no one there. Eluromancy. Concord, Massachusetts, October 1902. Leaving the fortune teller's tent and heading right, as she had suggested, Bailey almost immediately encounters a small crowd watching a performance. He cannot tell what it is at first. There is no raised platform involved. Peering through the space between spectators, he can see a hoop, larger than the one the contortionist used, held in the air. As he moves closer, he glimpses a black kitten leaping through it, landing somewhere out of sight. The woman in front of him with a large hat turns, and then he can see a young man about his own age, but a bit shorter, dressed in a black suit made of all manner of fabrics and a matching black hat. On his shoulders sits a pair of stark white kittens. As he lifts his black-gloved hand, palm open, one of the kittens jumps into it and bounces off his palm, leaping through the hoop, executing a rather impressive somersault at the pinnacle of its leap. Several members of the small audience laugh, and a few, including Bailey, applaud. The woman in the large hat steps aside completely, clearing Bailey's line of sight. His hands freeze in mid-clap when he sees the young lady who has just caught the white kitten and is now lifting it to her shoulder where it sits along with the black kitten. She is older, as he expected, and her red hair is somehow concealed within a white cap. But her costume is similar to the one she had been wearing when he last saw her. A patchwork dress of every fabric imaginable, each in tones of snowy white. A white jacket with lots of buttons and a pair of bright white gloves. She turns her head. Bailey catches her eye, and she smiles at him. Not in the way that one smiles at a random member of the audience when one is in the middle of performing circus tricks with unusually talented kittens, but in the way that one smiles when one recognizes someone they have not seen in some time. Bailey can tell the difference, and the fact that she remembers who he is makes him inexplicably and utterly pleased. He feels his ears getting rather hot, despite the cold of the night air. He watches the rest of the act with rapt attention, paying a fair deal more attention to the girl than the kittens, though the kittens are too impressive to ignore, and they steal his attention back periodically. When the act is finished, the girl and boy and kittens take a short bow, and the crowd claps and hoots. Bailey is wondering what he should say, if he should say anything, as the crowd begins to disperse. A man pushes in front of him, another woman blocks his way to the side, and he loses sight of the girl completely. He pushes through the throng of people, and when he is free of them, the girl and the boy and the kittens are nowhere to be seen. The crowd around him quickly dwindles to only a few people wandering up and down the pathway. There are no other directions to go as far as he can tell. Only tall, striped walls of tents line the area, and he turns around slowly, looking for any possible place they might have disappeared to, some corner or door. He is kicking himself for coming so close only to fail when there is a tap on his shoulder. "Hello, Bailey," the girl says. She is standing right behind him. She has taken off her hat, her red hair falling in waves around her shoulders, and she has replaced her white jacket with a heavy black coat and a knit scarf in a vibrant violet. Only the ruffled hem of her dress and her white boots give any indication that she is the same girl who was performing in the same spot moments ago. Otherwise, she looks like any other patron at the circus. "Hello," Bailey says. "I don't know your name." "Oh, I'm sorry," she says. "I forgot that we were never properly introduced." She holds out her white-gloved hand, and Bailey notices that it is larger than the glove he was given as proof of a long-ago dare.
"I'm Penelope, but no one ever calls me that. I don't really like it anyway. So for all intents and purposes, my name is Poppet."
Bailey takes her hand and shakes it. It is warmer than he expected, even through two layers of glove.
"Poppet," Bailey repeats. "The fortune teller told me that, but I didn't realize it was your name."
The girl smiles at him.
"You saw Isabel?"
she asks. Bailey nods.
"Isn't she lovely?"
Bailey continues to nod, though he's not sure nodding is an appropriate response.
"Did she tell you anything good about your future?"
Poppet asks, lowering her voice to a dramatic whisper.
"She told me a lot of things I didn't understand," Bailey confesses.
Poppet nods knowingly.
"She does that," Poppet says, "but she means well."
"Are you allowed to be out here like this?" Bailey asks, indicating the steady stream of circus patrons that continues to wander by, completely ignoring them.
"Oh, yes," Poppet says, "as long as we're incognito."
She indicates her coat.
"No one really gives us a second glance, right, Widget?"
She turns to a young man standing nearby, who Bailey had not even recognized as Poppet's performance partner. He has switched his black jacket for a tweedy brown one, and his hair, under his matching cap, is just as shockingly red as Poppet's.
"People don't pay much attention to anything unless you give them reason to," he says. "Though the hair helps, too, for looking like we don't belong in a black-and-white circus. Bailey, this is my brother, Winston," Poppet says. "Widget," he corrects. "I was getting to that."
Poppet says, sounding a bit cross.
And Wedge, this is Bailey.
Pleased to meet you, Bailey says, offering his hand.
Likewise,
Widget responds in turn.
We were off for a walk, if you'd like to join us. Do come, please,
Poppet adds.
We hardly ever have company.
Sure, I'd like that, Bailey says. He cannot think of a single reason to refuse, and is pleased that they both seem remarkably easy to talk to. Do you not have to do any more, circus things?
Not for a few hours, at least,
Widget says, as they start off down another pathway through the circus.
The kittens need to nap. Performing makes them sleepy.
They're very good. How do you make them do all those tricks? I've never seen a cat do a somersault in midair, Bailey says. He notices that all three of them are walking at the same pace, staying easily together as a group. He is much more used to following a few steps behind.
Most cats will do anything if you ask them nicely, Poppet says, but it helps to train them early. And to give them lots of treats,
Widget adds.
Treats always help. Have you seen the big cats?
Poppet asks. Bailey shakes his head.
Oh, you should. Our parents do the big cat show. Their tent is down that way.
She points in a direction vaguely to the right.
It's like our performance, only with bigger cats,
Widget says.
Much bigger cats,
Poppet elaborates.
Panthers and beautiful spotted snow leopards. They're sweet, really. And they have a tent,
Widget adds. Why don't you have a tent? Bailey asks.
We don't really need one,
Poppet says.
We can only do a few shows a night, and all we need are the kittens and hoops and strings and things. Anyone who doesn't really need a tent performs wherever there's room. It adds to the ambience,
Widget says.
So you can see bits of the circus without having to pick a tent to go into, just wandering around.
That's probably very good for indecisive people, Bailey says, smiling when Poppet and Widget both laugh.
It is hard to choose a tent, you know, when there are so many. That's true,
Poppet says. They've reached the bonfire courtyard. It is quite crowded, and Bailey is still surprised that no one pays them much attention, assuming that they are just the same as any group of young circus patrons visiting for the evening.
I'm hungry,
Widget says.
You're always hungry, Poppet retorts. Shall we get something to eat?
Yes,
Widget says. Poppet sticks her tongue out at him.
I was asking Bailey, she says. Shall we get something to eat, Bailey?
Sure, Bailey says. Poppet and Widget seem to get along much better than he and Caroline ever have, and he assumes it is because they are closer to the same age. He wonders if they are twins. They certainly look enough alike to be twins, and he thinks it might be rude to ask.
Have you tried the cinnamon things?
Poppet asks.
They're rather new. What are they called, Widge? Fantastically delicious cinnamon things?
Widget says, shrugging.
I don't think all of the new things have names yet.
I haven't, but they sound good, Bailey says.
They are good,
Widget says.
Layers of pastry and cinnamon and sugar all rolled into a twist and covered in icing.
Wow, Bailey says.
Exactly,
Widget replies.
And we should get some cocoa and some chocolate mice.
I have chocolate mice, Bailey says, pulling the bag out of his pocket. I bought them earlier.
Ah, you think ahead. Very good to be prepared,
Widget says.
You were right about him, Poppet.
Bailey looks at Poppet quizzically, but she only smiles at him.
Shall Bailey and I get cocoa while you get the cinnamon whatnots?
She asks, and Widget nods his approval of this plan.
Certainly. Meet you at the bonfire?
He asks. Poppet nods, and Widget tips his hat to them both and goes off into the crowd. Bailey and Poppet continue to walk around the bonfire courtyard. After a few moments of amicable silence, Bailey works up the nerve to ask a question. One, he's not sure he'll be comfortable asking once they meet back up with Widget.
Can I ask you something?
Bailey asks.
Of course,
Poppet says. There is a bit of a line for Coco, but the vendor notices Poppet, who flashes three fingers at him, and he smiles and nods in return.
When the circus was here last time and I...
Well... Bailey struggles for words, annoyed that the question seems simpler in his head.
Yes,
Puppet says.
How did you know my name?
Bailey asks.
And how did you know I was there?
Puppet says, as though she is having difficulty finding the proper words to respond with.
It's not easy to explain,
she starts.
I see things before they happen. I saw you come in, not long before you got there, and I don't always see details well. But when I saw you, I knew what your name was, like knowing that your scarf is blue.
They reach the front of the line, and the vendor has three cups of cocoa in striped cups waiting for them already, with clouds of extra whipped cream on top. Poppet hands one to Bailey and takes the other to herself, and Bailey notices that the vendor waved them off with no money having changed hands. He assumes that free cocoa is a benefit of being a member of the circus.
So you see everything before it happens?
Bailey asks. He is not sure Poppet's answer is entirely what he expected, if he expected anything at all. Poppet shakes her head.
No, not everything. Sometimes just bits of things, like words and pictures in a book. But the book has lots of pages missing, and it's been dropped in a pond, and some parts are blurry, but other parts aren't. Does that make sense?
She asks. Not really, Bailey answers. Puppet laughs.
I know it's strange,
she says.
No, it's not, Bailey says.
Puppet turns to look at him, the skepticism at the statement evident on her face.
Well, yes, it is kind of strange, but just odd strange, not bad strange. Thank you, Bailey,
Puppet says. They circle the courtyard, heading back to the bonfire. Widget is waiting for them, holding a black paper bag and watching the vibrant white flames.
What took you so long?
Widget asks.
We had a line,
Puppet says, handing him his cocoa.
Didn't you? No, I don't think people have figured out how good these things are yet,
Widget says, shaking the bag.
Are we set then? I think so,
Puppet says. Where are we going? Bailey asks. Puppet and Widget exchange a glance before Puppet answers.
We're doing rounds, she says. Circles of the circus to keep an eye on things. You do want to come with us, don't you?
Of course, Bailey says, relieved that he is not an imposition. They walk in loops around the circus, sipping their cocoa and munching on chocolate mice and the sugary cinnamon pastry things, which are just as good as promised. Puppet and Widget tell him stories of the circus, pointing out tents as they pass by, and Bailey answers their questions about his town, finding it strange that they seem interested in what he considers very mundane things. They speak with the ease of people who have known each other for years, and the excitement of new friends with new stories. If Puppet and Widget are keeping an eye on anything beyond their cocoa and himself, Bailey cannot tell what it might be.
What's the Stargazer?
He asks, catching sight of a sign he has not seen before as they discard their empty cups and bags.
Up for gazing, Puppet,
Widget asks his sister. She pauses before she nods.
Puppet reads the stars, he explains to Bailey. It's the easiest place to see the future. It hasn't been all that easy lately,
Puppet says quietly,
but we can ride. It's only open on clear nights, so who knows if we'll get another chance while we're here.
They step inside, joining a line that ascends a curving stairway around the perimeter, separated from the interior of the tent by a heavy black curtain. The walls are covered in diagrams, white spots and lines on black paper, framed maps of constellations.
Is it like the way the fortune teller reads those cards with pictures on them?
Bailey asks, still trying to wrap his mind around the idea of seeing the future.
Sort of like that, but different,
Puppet says.
I can't read tarot cards at all, but Widget can. They're stories on paper,
Widget says, shrugging.
You see how the stories in each card go together. It's not really that hard, but with those, you have all different possibilities and things, different paths to take.
Poppet sees things that actually happen. But they're not as clear, Poppet explains. There isn't context, and most of the time I don't know what things mean until later. Sometimes not until it's too late.
Disclaimers accepted, pet, Widget says, giving her shoulder a squeeze. It can just be a ride if you want.
At the top of the stairs, they reach a black platform where everything is endlessly dark, save for a circus worker in a white suit who is guiding patrons inside. He smiles at Poppet and Widget with a curious glance at Bailey as he escorts them through the darkness into something like a sleigh or a carriage. They slide onto a cushioned bench with a high back and sides, the door on one side clicking closed as Poppet settles in between Bailey and Widget. It glides forward slowly, and Bailey can see nothing but darkness. Then something around them clicks softly, and the carriage falls just a bit, and at the same time it tilts backward, so they are looking up instead of forward. The tent has no top, Bailey realizes. The upper portion of it is open, with the night sky fully visible. It is a different sensation than watching the stars while lying in a field, something Bailey has done many times. There are no trees creeping into the edges, and the gentle swaying of the carriage makes him feel almost weightless. And it is incredibly quiet. As the carriage moves along in what seems to be a circular pattern, Bailey can hear nothing but a soft creak and the sound of Poppet breathing next to him. It is as though the entire circus has faded away into the darkness. He glances over at Poppet, who is looking at him instead of the sky. She gives him a grin and then turns away. Bailey wonders if he should ask if she sees anything in the stars.
You don't have to, if you don't want to,
Widget says, anticipating the question. Poppet turns to make a face at him, but then focuses her gaze upward, looking into the clear night sky. Bailey watches her carefully. She looks as though she is contemplating a painting or reading a sign from far away, squinting just a little. She stops suddenly, putting her hands to her face, pressing her white-gloved fingers over her eyes. Widget puts a hand on her shoulder.
"Are you all right?" Bailey asks.
Poppet takes a deep breath before she nods, keeping her hands over her face.
"I'm fine," she says with a muffled voice. "It was very bright. It made my head hurt."
She takes her hands from her face and shakes her head. Whatever distress she had been in has apparently passed. For the remainder of the ride, none of them look up at the star-speckled sky.
"I'm sorry,"
Bailey says quietly as they walk down another curving stairway in order to exit.
"It's not your fault," Poppet says. "I should have known better. The stars have been doing that lately, making no sense, and giving me headaches. I should probably stop trying for a while."
"You need some cheering,"
Widget says as they return to the din of the circus.
"Cloud maze?"
Poppet nods, her shoulders relaxing a bit.
"What's the cloud maze?" Bailey asks. "You haven't found any of the best tents yet, have you?"
Widget says, shaking his head.
"You're going to have to come back. We can't do all of them in one night. Maybe that's why Pet got a headache. She saw us having to drag you through every single tent to see what you've been missing."
"Widge can see the past,"
Poppet said suddenly, diverting the conversation.
"It's one of the reasons his stories are always so good." "The past is easier," Widget says. "It's already there."
"In the stars?" Bailey asks.
"No," Widget says. "On people. The past stays on you, the way powdered sugar stays on your fingers. Some people can get rid of it, but it's still there. The events and things that pushed you to where you are now. I can, well, read isn't the right word, but there's not the right word for what Poppet does with the stars either."
"So you can see my past on me?" Bailey asks.
"I could," Widget says. "I try not to do it without permission if there's nothing that jumps out automatically. Do you mind?"
Bailey shakes his head.
"Not at all."
Widget stares at him for a moment, not quite long enough for Bailey to become uncomfortable under the weight of his eyes, but almost.
There's a tree, Widget says. This massive old oak tree. That's more home to you than your house, but not as much as this is.
He gestures around at the tent